Okay, hey, we're glad to have you here. Welcome to Quest. For those of you joining online, thank you for getting connected. And for those of you here who are new, we are so glad to have you here. If you want to fill out a welcome card, that would be awesome, and just say, hey, I was here, or if you have a prayer request, write it down. I'm Jonathan. I serve on the pastoral staff here, and it is great to be with you. I'm excited. And really quick, kind of side, totally unrelated note to where we're going to go next. Next week, I will be gone. I will be at summer camp. So we have a group of teenagers out at camp, like an hour away from the church building, at Camp Wartburg in Illinois. And it's going to be great. We partnered with a few other EFCA churches in St. Louis. And so I won't be here. But if you think about us, pray for us. Pray for our students. Pray for what God's doing in their lives. And it's just having a change of place and change of pace, it brings change perspective. Kind of slow down, get out of the normal rhythms, and to be focused on God with each other. It's a tremendous time of growing, so be praying for us at camp. We would love that. And then we'll be back, and we'll be sleep-deprived, but it'll be great. Okay, so movies. You guys, it sounds like you had a lot of movies you've seen, right? Okay, Top Gun. Who's seen Top Gun? All right, a lot of you guys. Okay, good. Haven't seen it, but good. Okay. So there's a lot of power in a good movie or a good line from a movie. So sometimes you have like a famous quote and you hear the quote and it brings to mind the whole movie and everything associated with it. So we're going to do a little test, a little trial to see if you know your movie quotes, okay? So what's this from? You're not Santa. You smell like beef and cheese. Elf. Elf. Like, and it brings the whole scene and the whole movie back to you. And all the that. Okay, what about this? Just keep swimming. Finding Nemo. Finding Dory's. Just keep swimming. Just keep swimming. Now that'll be in your head all morning, so you're welcome. Okay, what about we're not in Kansas anymore? Wizard of Oz. Okay, confession. I've never seen The Wizard of Oz. But I know the quote. I know it's from the movie. Okay, haven't seen it. Should I see it? Okay, anyone say no? I was always told, eh. Okay, good. Okay, anyone else not seen it? Okay, I am alone on that. Okay, what about this? You're killing me, Smalls. Sandlot, you're killing me, Smalls. Sandlot and brings lots of pleasant feelings back. Okay, what about, that'll do, Pig. That'll do. Babe. It's the first movie I saw in theaters, I think. Maybe show my age right there. Okay, what about this? I feel the need for speed. Top Gun. I'm told that's in Top Gun. I've never seen it. The new one or the original. Total confession. The staff here at Quest makes fun of me relentlessly. What? It's relentless. Haven't seen it. Do I need to see it before I see the second? Fine. Okay. I've heard it's good. I've heard it's good. All right, what about I See Dead People? Sixth Sense. Yeah, and you're like, oh, Bruce Willis, and he's been dead the whole time, and like that's the spoiler. So like now you're on. It's been out for like 25 years. Like, you can spoil movies that have been out that long. Okay. What about I'm King of the World? Titanic. Yeah, Titanic. Rest in peace, Jack. There's totally room for you on that raft at the end. There was, like, totally. All right, what about you can't handle the truth? Few Good Men. And that line, it even just saying it gives me just chills. Like, it is so moving and so intense. What about no, I am your father? Star Wars, Episode 4. He's like, you killed my father. He's like, no, I am your father. So you hear this line, and it brings back the whole movie. It's memorable. It connects with something. You have all these memories and feelings associated with that story, the whole thing, the emotions that come with it. What we're going to read this morning in the Gospel of Matthew is that sort of moment in the Gospel of Matthew. It won't maybe feel as cool or intense. Maybe it will. I hope it does. But maybe it doesn't. It doesn't have the emotional connection you have to Top Gun or Wizard of Oz. But it will, or Babe or Titanic. I don't know, whatever. But it's that sort of moment where there's this key line, and it's a turning point. It's a climactic point that things have been building up to, and everything flows from the conversation we're going to see with Jesus and his disciples today. So it's going to be big. I'm excited, and it. So I just mentioned it's kind of things have built to this point. We're in this series in Matthew called Kingdom Intensified, and it's this portion of Jesus' ministry where he's with his followers and things are getting more and more intense. There's greater crowds, there's greater people gathering, there's these big miracles, and there's intense teaching where Jesus is really calling people to some new depths of discipleship, of following him, of surrendering to him. And there's also increased opposition. More and more pushback, more and more at stake. And so last week, just if you remember back in Matthew 16, we saw Jesus and he was challenged by these two groups, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. These two groups, they come from different sides of the theological spectrum, different kind of camps of Judaism, but they united together to try to take Jesus down. We read about them coming to test Jesus, and they said, "Jesus, show us a sign. We want to see a sign. We want to see you do something." And I think, in one sense, to give him a chance to maybe discredit himself, to put him on the spot, and if he can't do it, like, oh man, he's done. Or maybe he does do it, and then they can kind of sideshow him and put him on America's Got Talent and really try to get him to do these magic tricks and make him put him in that world. Discredit him or minimize him. That's what they were out to do. Because the Sadducees were this group of, they were religious to a degree, but they were a big political and social movement. They were the social elite of Judaism. They really had compromised with Rome. So Rome is the big superpower. And they said, yeah, we'll kind of betray some key parts of Judaism, key parts of what it means to be the people of God, because we like the money, the prestige, the privilege, the power that comes with kind of being in the circle of influence on the side of the Romans, or at least wanting to kind of play that balance. So the Sadducees didn't want a Messiah to come along and then kind of upset what they did, calling them out. They didn't want a revolutionary because then Rome would come in and put their foot down and say, "Sadducees, come on, you're not keeping it together." And then, so they come together, and they're together with the Pharisees, who are a group that are fairly well known. That's a word that comes to mind a lot when we think about the opponents of Jesus. They were these religious scholars, these religious, intense kind of zealots that were really focused on purity. They said, yeah, groups like the Sadducees, they've compromised with Rome. That's part of the problem. What we need to do is become hyper-religious. The Sadducees kind of bought into secular liberalism. They said, we're going to do our own thing. We're free. We don't really need the God piece as much. And the Pharisees said, no, we need to get back to our roots. And we need to go back to the law. And we need to get intense about it. So we're going to add all these other laws. And we need people to follow. And they had a lot of popular support. A lot of people liked that. A lot of people saw it as a renewal movement, but Jesus had challenged them too because they said, we want to get back to what's really important, the roots, and they get back to the law, and they miss the lawgiver. They miss God himself. And so Jesus confronts both groups simultaneously, the very hyper-religious and the irreligious, and he confronts both of them, and he says to his followers, I want you to follow me, to line up with me and my agenda. Not theirs. It's me, the Savior who's going to die and be raised from the dead. It's the sign of Jonah, 3 days in the ground and the belly of the fish that risen to new life. That's what I want you to be about, to be enthusiastically following me. And then that leads us to this question that I think we're all confronted with, kind of repeatedly in the Gospels, of really wondering, who is Jesus? Who is this person? There's this amazing teaching, there's these miraculous events, there's these incredible claims, these really challenging, uncomfortable passages and words, and you're wondering, who is this? Who is the one who can demand allegiance to follow him? And who's the one who can speak with this authority? Who is Jesus? And that's what we'll see today. We'll see that kind of come to a forefront on who he is, and we'll see three things. We'll see revelation, we'll see some things revealed about who Jesus is, we will see confusion about Jesus, revelation, confusion, and we'll see an invitation to follow. So revelation, confusion, invitation, that's where we're going. And with that, let's take a moment and pray and invite God to speak to us. Jesus, open up our eyes to see you. Open up our ears and our hearts to hear you so that we can know you more clearly. We can be drawn into a deeper relationship with you where you would meet us in the midst of whatever weeks we've had, the good and the bad and the broken edges and in between. Speak to us. And we ask this in your name. Amen. So, Matthew chapter 16. We're starting in verse 13 to 28. It's kind of these three paragraphs, these three sections. And starting in verse 13 to 20, here's a revelation. Here's something revealed. It says this, "Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, 'Who do the people say that the Son of Man is?'" That is referring to himself. They're in Caesarea Philippi. We like maps a lot here at Quest, so here's our map. He spends a lot of time in Galilee, kind of the northern part of Israel. That's where a lot of his ministry is. And then Jerusalem's down in the south where eventually he goes. But this happens up in Caesarea Philippi, which is like 20-plus miles north. There's these foothills overlooking the Jordan River Valley and south of this big mountain, Mount Hebron. And it's this town called Caesarea Philippi, named by Herod Philip. He gave it this name to Caesar Augustus. He says, "I'm going to honor you, Caesar Augustus. So we'll call it Caesarea, Caesar." And then he's like, "And Philip, like after me." Like, "Caesar, it's really for you. Well, both of us. We'll name it after both of us, Caesarea Philippi." So it's known for that, and it's known for two other things. One, the conversation they have here today. And secondly, there's this famous shrine to this pagan god called Pan. A long time before it was Canaanite religion and Baal, but there's this really big religious connection to this god and this idol called Pan. So it's known for being a Gentile area and the worship of this other god. And Jesus brings his disciples up here, kind of out into the foothills, and I think it's a little bit of a retreat where he tells the disciples, "We have some things to talk about. Let's go a little deeper. Let's do a change of place, change of pace, change of perspective," right? And then we read, he says, "Who do the people say that I am? Who do the people say the Son of Man is?" This was one of Jesus' favorite titles, partly, I think, or mainly, I think, because it's kind of a mysterious, enigmatic title. Like, a Son of a Man, does that just mean a human being, the son of another human being? Which sometimes a lot of people took it that way. But there's also these passages in the Old Testament that speak about this Son of Man being a Messiah, a deliverer, who is actually united with God himself, who has authority over the whole earth. In Daniel chapter 7, there's kind of these key passages of that. And so some people are thinking, I wonder if that's who Jesus is claiming to be. So it's a term that had some mystery. Outsiders are like, what's that all about? And insiders are like, what's that all about? Why do you keep referring to yourself in this way, Jesus? And here he says, okay, what are you hearing? What's the word on the street? What are the posts people are making? Who do people say the Son of Man is? And then, so they say, some say John the Baptist, right? John the Baptist had been killed and executed. Herod thought, oh, he's back from the dead. That's who this Jesus is. Maybe it's him. And others say Elijah or Jeremiah or one of the prophets. These are these famous Old Testament figures who are prophets. They called people back to God. They spoke for God. They called people back, and they had a lot of messages of doom and gloom and repentance, like come back, and Jesus had a lot of that. So some people are trying to figure out who Jesus is. Is this just one of the prophets? Is it one of them who died long ago back? Who is this guy? And then Jesus, I think being a good teacher, a good rabbi, then calls his disciples to say, okay, now what about you? Here's all you're thinking. Here's all you're hearing. What do you really believe about me? Who am I? Put him on the spot. Who am I? And the Greek here is emphatic. He says, what about you? Who do you say that I am? I don't want to hear about what other people think now. Tell me yourself. And I think like a good teacher, he wants to draw it out. He wants to dive into this. And they've spent a lot of time with Jesus. They've spent a lot of time seeing miracles, powerful teaching, authority, exorcisms, all sorts of amazing miracles over nature, calming the storm, and they're like, wow, that's big. They also see Jesus, they walk on dirt paths for miles and miles and miles. They sleep with a rock for a pillow, and they've seen Jesus' bedhead, which is not good when you sleep on a rock, and they're like, they've seen all that. They've been with Jesus, who is fully human being. They're very aware of that, and they're also seeing these other pieces of some miraculous, supernatural pieces of his identity that they're wrestling through. And so Jesus says, okay, it's been a couple years. It's been a while. who do you say that I am? And then, it's great. Here is the climactic, no, I'm your father moment of the Gospel of Matthew. He says this. Peter speaks up in verse 16, and he says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." You are the Christ. That's the word Messiah. It means Messiah. So Jesus Christ means Jesus the Messiah. It's not his last name. It's just a title that was attributed all this authority. You are the Messiah, the rescuer, the deliverer. That is you. And the Son of the living God. Now, a lot of the time, Peter, he sticks his foot in his mouth. You're like reading through, and he's so hot-headed at times, and he jumps all in, and he gets himself in trouble a lot. But here, he actually, I think, hits a nail on the head. He spent all this time with these other disciples. They've seen the events. They've asked the questions. And I think speaking representatively for them, he steps up and he says, you are Messiah, Jesus. And you come from God himself. You're the Son of the living God. You're not just a prophet. You're not just a good teacher. You come from God. And it's this amazing confession of faith. Here in Caesarea Philippi, a place that is known for the worship of other gods, that's mostly more Gentile, not Jewish, Jesus in that context says, okay, where do I line up in your world? And they say, you are the Messiah. Peter's, you are the Messiah. You come from God himself. And so Peter confesses it. He says, this is what I believe. And Jesus confirms it. In verse 17, he says, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, which means Simon, son of Jonah. For flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. It's actually not something you come to know on your own. It's God himself revealing it to you. I am the Messiah. God has revealed it to you. And you're blessed, Peter. You're so blessed because you get it. That's the revelation. Jesus says, I am the Messiah. And nowhere else in the Gospel of Matthew have we seen this articulated this clearly. We've never seen the disciples really speak about it, although there's questions about, like, who is Jesus? Is he the Messiah? And there's tensions along the way, but never do they finally come out and say it. And never does Jesus totally affirm it until now, where he says, yes, I am the Messiah, the deliverer, the rescuer, the anointed one, where God's Spirit is upon me. That is me. I'm here. It's this big reveal for people who had spiritual eyes to see it. And it, I think, pushes each of us to reflect a little bit for ourselves about, okay, what do we really believe about Jesus? What do we really think? The disciples, it took them a couple years of spending time with him, doing life with him. It was a process of learning, of uncovering his identity, and they had to get to know him and figure out, okay, what do I really believe? Where am I at? Who do I think he is? Is he just a good teacher? Is he just someone who is charismatic, he's good at, and he's calling out the people I want him to call out, or maybe just a miracle worker, or is he kind of deluded, kind of delusional, thinking he's the Messiah? He says things like, I forgive you of sin. Like, only God can do that, Jesus. Jesus says, yes, that is true. But, you know, these questions, like, is he a crazy person? Is he the real deal? Who is Jesus? And the disciples, so first, they had a lot of time to think about this question. And you and me, it sometimes takes a long time to think about that. And secondly, I think we have to figure out for ourselves, who really is he? And we have to get to know him on his terms. We have to spend time with him, read through the accounts of Jesus' life, read through the Gospels and say, okay, what do I really believe? Where do I land? Is he just a nice guy, a good teacher? Is there more? Is he Messiah? So if you're here this morning and you're like, I'm not sure where I'm at, I would just say keep diving into this journey of trying to figure him out, learn from him, spend time with him, read through these accounts of Jesus' life. And maybe for some of us, it's just saying, okay, I want to evaluate Jesus on Jesus, not all the other things that his followers have done and said that maybe don't represent Jesus well or maybe completely misrepresent Jesus. Jesus, I think, wants us to really get to know him on his own terms. Jesus here, in this passage, he's really claiming it. He's putting it on the line. This is who I am. Who do you say I am? The Messiah? you are blessed because God has revealed it to you, Simon. And I think to the disciples, that is me. I am the Messiah. I don't think he said it in the same voice of Darth Vader saying, I am your father, but it carried that same sort of weight where I think the disciples had to say, whoa, he's the Messiah, this is it. And then he goes on, and he affirms Peter even more. In verse 18, he says, I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. You are Peter. So maybe you've often known his name as Peter, but he was given that name by Jesus. His original name was Simon. And Peter is the Greek word Petros, which means rock. So here he says, you are Peter, you are Petros, and on this Petra, I will build my church. So it's this, you see this play on words, right? Jesus is saying, okay, Peter, you're the rock, or you're rocky. Not like in a shaky way, but in like a Rocky Balboa from the movie Rocky. Okay, I haven't seen that one either. but I do know he says Adrian, right? He says something about Adrian. Okay. okay, so he's Rocky. He's Rocky Balboa. Peter, you are the real deal. You are the foundation. You are solid. That's you. And I'm going to build my church on this sort of thing, on you. You're a rock. And I think that's the reference where he says, Peter, that you are the rock. I'm going to build, you are a foundational pillar to this early church, this early movement of Jesus followers, which we see all through the Gospels, all through the book of Acts and the letters. Peter's a tremendous advocate for Jesus, a tremendous missionary, and does amazing work and dies for Jesus. And it's a foundational pillar. And his confession here is a foundational pillar for who he is and for us. But it doesn't say anything about Peter being, about his authority. It doesn't say anything about him being infallible, of not being wrong. We'll see in a couple verses he gets some things wrong. It doesn't say anything about kind of Peter's authority being transferred on. I think it's Jesus just saying, you're rock. You're the rocky. You're Peter. I'm building on this. And I think the real emphasis we actually lose. The real emphasis is Jesus saying, I will build my church. I will build my church. It's his church. Church not being a building, but being a people. He's reorienting all the people of Israel around himself, saying, actually, the dividing line to get in or out is me. It's me. I am the Messiah. And if it's really me, it's not your nationality or ethnicity that gets you in. It's not all the religious badges of honor you have. It's how you respond to me, what you believe about me. And he's saying, and I will build my church. It's my people. Everyone else, you're just under shepherds. You're involved and you have some privilege and responsibility, but it's really Jesus. It's Quest is Jesus's church. He is in charge. It's his. And Jesus here, I think, is saying, really trying to emphasize his role in it as the master builder. He's the master builder. Peter, he's a rock. But in other passages, we see Jesus say, I'm the cornerstone. I'm the first stone, the corner one, that every other stone is oriented around and built on. It's really me. But the image here is, he's like, okay, Peter, you're a rock. I'm going to build. But I'm the one building. And I am the one who's going to build my church. That's the emphasis. And then he says, this is amazing, he says, in the gates of hell, they will not prevail against it. The defensive structures of death, of hell, of spiritual forces of darkness, they cannot stand. They will fall. And they will not last. And what a comforting thing to hear. What a comforting thing to hear. Like, evil will be dealt with. This Messiah who has come, he will deal with it. Hell will not stand. He will destroy those who oppose the enemy and the work that he's doing to oppose Jesus. The enemy will not win. Jesus is saying, I am the Messiah. It's mine. I'm doing it. And hell will not stop me. And then we have this curious little blessing on Peter, another kind of element. We're not going to spend a lot of time here, but look with me in verse 19 to 20. He says, and I will give you the keys of the kingdom, Peter. And whatever you bind on earth, it shall be bound in heaven. And whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. like whatever's tied up or whatever's released. Then he strictly charges the disciples, tell no one that I'm the Christ. Tell no one. So really quickly, this idea of keys and keys of the kingdom, it's kind of a curious phrase, and there's a lot to unpack. We'll actually talk about it more in our next series in Matthew, because here he gives the keys to Peter, but in Matthew 18, he gives them to all the apostles, and I think extends to the church. So it's not something that's just special with Peter here. This is a broader picture of him saying, okay, I'm giving you a key. And I think the key, what do keys do? Keys are access points. They represent getting in or closing something off to say that's not okay. And Peter is in a unique position as an apostle, as a follower of Jesus, to be able to open the doors and to close the doors. If people reject the message of God, if people reject Jesus, he can say, okay, we're moving on to the next town. And they do that. And the door is closed. He's used the key to close. But other times, they go to a place and he opens the door in ministry and Jesus expands and flourishes. And I think that's really what it's about. It's about the gospel message and authority to proclaim it. And then to regulate within the church to say, and this is not okay in this house, and this is okay in this house that Jesus is building. So we'll talk about more about the keys in Matthew 18 when we get there. But it's just this unique picture of Jesus kind of further building upon his followers and saying, you are a part of something really special. If I'm the Messiah, you have a responsibility and a privilege here that is incredible. But then he says, don't tell anyone. Shh, keep it on the down low. When we get back in town, don't tell people what I just told you. Does that feel weird? Like, come on, Jesus, you can't tell me not to tell anyone. Or you wonder, like, why would you say no? And think back to earlier, we saw these two groups of people opposing Jesus, the Sadducees and Pharisees. The Sadducees were afraid of a political warrior Messiah that a lot of people wanted. They said, we want a Messiah. Messiah for them meant he's going to come. He's going to be a military victory warrior type. He's going to kick out the bad guys. He's going to deal with all the mess. That's what we need, someone to come in and be a political warrior Messiah. And Jesus, he isn't that. But he doesn't, I think, want to get sucked into other their agenda. Or the religious people saying, we need someone to come in and purify and get rid of all the religious establishment who's got it wrong. And that's what your target is, Jesus. You go do that. And Jesus says, no, I'm not going to let you define my agenda for me. But I don't want to get sucked into all of these things just at this point in my ministry. Later in the Gospels, especially towards his death and kind of at the end of his life, it really ramps up and the tensions are swirling around. But I think at this point, Jesus doesn't want that to derail the mission and derail what they're doing. He wants it to be this internal process still for the disciples to think through who is Jesus and what does it mean and not imposing their agenda on him, which is actually what we see in the next verse. Look with me in verse 21. There's confusion. So revelation, Jesus is the Messiah. He reveals it. But then confusion in verse 21. From that time, Jesus says he began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, that he must suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, and to be killed, and on the third day to be raised. From this point on, he's very direct with his followers. We'll see him say this a few different times where he says, you guys, I'm going to Jerusalem. I will be slain. I will be killed. This is going to happen. It's actually something I have come to do, to give my life as a ransom for many. I've come to do this. And it's not the end of the story. The grave is not the end of the story. It's the resurrected Messiah. I'll be back to new life, conquering death and sin. That's the biggest enemy we're going after here. It's not just Rome or the religious folks you don't like. It's death and sin and hell that I'm going to conquer. That's what I'm about. And so he starts telling his followers this, and then there's some confusion about that, though. Like, is Jesus unclear about this? I don't think so. I feel like it's pretty, like, Jesus says, this is what I'm doing. But look, and Peter, in verse 22, this is great and horrible and great. He says, Peter took him aside, and he began to rebuke him. Peter says, hold on a second, Jesus. Stop. We're going to get off the path. He pulls Jesus aside, and he says, far be it from you, Lord. this shall never happen to you? Like, seriously, Jesus? That's what you're doing? Not happening. Not on my watch. Can you imagine, like, the disciples kind of off over here like, oh, Peter, what are you saying? Like, disciples never pull the rabbi aside and correct him and say, hey, you're wrong. Like, you kind of missed on this. Much less when it's like, your whole identity, Jesus, is totally wrong. What you're saying you've come to do is so wrong. You can't do this, Jesus. Never. Never. And when you tell Jesus what he can and can't do, that's not a good spot to be in life. But it's his own agenda. And I don't know all what's going on in his heart, but his vision, his expectation for the Messiah and what he expected him to do didn't match up with a suffering Messiah. That's the confusion. Jesus says, I am the Messiah, but secondly, he says, I am the suffering Messiah. I am the Messiah who's come to sacrifice, to suffer for you. And Peter's like, that's not what I want. Not happening. And Jesus' response is so strong. It's even stronger than Peter's rebuke. He says this in verse 23. He turned to Peter and he said, get behind me, Satan. Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me. You are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. Get behind me. Okay. Five verses earlier, Peter, you're rocky, the rock. You're the one we're building on. That confession, that sort of thing, the confessing Peter, that's it. And he says right here, you are a messenger, a mouthpiece. You are saying things that are not from God. They're from the enemy. You're tempting me, saying, go down this path. Don't go the suffering Messiah route. That's hard and painful and not worth. Don't do that. Be the victorious. Be the cool Messiah, be the whatever, I don't know his expectations, but it didn't match up. And so he says, Jesus says, you're not thinking about the things of God, what I've really come to do. You're actually opposing God. He says, you're a hindrance to me. Now this word hindrance is a Greek word it means it's scandalo, which means to scandalize. It's this word that means the word picture is it's a stumbling stone. And therefore, it causes people to trip, and therefore they're scandalized. They get mixed up. They get confused. So here he said, five verses earlier, you're a rock. We're building on that. And here he says, you are a stone that people are tripping over. People are stubbing their toes on. Like, Peter, your rockhood status depends on what you're saying and doing. Here you're just getting in the way. You're in the way. You're not a rock that we're building upon. You are a rock we are tripping on. You're a scandal. You're a scandal. You're hindering. So Peter's status depends on what he says and does, which is, this resonates so closely for us. The more we think about it, the more we realize, oh man, I want Jesus to be the Messiah that I want him to be. I want to set the agenda for Jesus or for God in my life. We get confused on that all the time, and it's on one level comforting that Peter can have such a big moment of truth and knowing who God is and who Jesus is, and then to struggle and get confused on the journey along the way. I mean, it's hard, but it's such a breath of fresh air to see the humanness and to see Jesus really call him to follow him. And so we can learn from Peter's success and his failure, because we want a Messiah that does the sort of things we want him to do. So first we had to figure out, okay, who do we really believe Jesus is? And secondly, are we willing to let Jesus be the kind of Messiah that he says he is? Or how? What are the ways that you've told him, no, Jesus, no, God, I want it this way. Thank you very much. I'm defining this for myself, to put ourselves on the throne. Like, are we really willing to let Jesus be the God, or be the on the throne of our life, to say, I'm not going to self-determine for myself to be... I don't want Jesus to just, sometimes we want him to be a genie in a bottle that'll give us three wishes to give us the good life, nice and easy. Like, sometimes we really, our self-determination is so deep in our hearts, and we don't let God be God. We don't let Jesus be the suffering Messiah. We want the Messiah who just gives a rubber stamp and gives us what we want. And that's not it. The cosmic slot machine. He's like, that's not me. I'm a Messiah who suffers. And then he says, I'm going to give you an invitation. This is who I am, and I'm going to invite you. Look with me. Verse 24, Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. That's the invitation, and that's the challenge. Take this wooden structure that will ultimately crush you and kill you, but you're going to follow me. And then he goes on, and he says, for whoever will save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake, he will find it. What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and yet forfeits his soul? What shall a man give in return for his soul? Jesus says, I'm the Messiah, I'm the suffering Messiah, and I invite you to follow me. Because this is actually the path of true life, of dying to self, not living for yourself, but these things in life that you've given yourself to that actually are not the ultimate good in life, it will crush you. I need you to follow me and to die to self. And that feels a little bit uncomfortable and a little bit challenging. But Jesus is saying there's dire consequences. If you don't get this, you will lose your soul. You'll give your life to the wrong thing. So Dallas Willard is a famous philosopher, theologian. He put it this way in his book, Renovation of the Heart, on this passage. He says, what is this self-denial or death to self, which goes hand in hand with the restoration of the soul and eventually the whole person? At first, it sounds like some dreadfully negative thing that aims to annihilate us. And frankly, from the point of view of the ruined soul, self-denial is and will always be every bit as brutal as it seems to most people on first approach. The ruined life is not to be enhanced, but to be replaced. We must simply lose our lives. And it's that ruined life about which most people complain so much anyway. He says, this is what Jesus is about. You need a renovation of your heart. You need a builder to come and build something new. The old actually has to go away. We're not trying to enhance the old ways of life. It's not a self-help sort of thing. It's actually a replacement of your life, a replacement of your heart. This ruined soul that we've destroyed by our selfishness, Jesus is saying, I want you to go on this path of renovating it, of letting me renovate it, and you have to die to these old things and live to me. So this leads us to our question, well, what about our hearts need renovated, need renewed? What are the things in our hearts that we don't want to give up? What are the things in our hearts that become so rooted and are so wrong that it will destroy us down the course of life? What are the parts of our life that need this? So maybe you spent your whole life just pursuing wealth, going after the dollar, going after a job, and along the way you've sacrificed your spouse, your kids, you've gone after the money. Money's part of life. It's part of life. Jobs are part of life. But if you sacrifice things along on the way, you're going to end up losing your soul, even though you think you're getting life. It's actually not it. Or maybe you're like, I wasn't able to get the job with the money, but I can go after pleasure. I can go after sex and food and money and drink, and I can go after all these things to just get comfort, 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 and then eventually you realize I've kind of run dry on that. It doesn't actually satisfy you. You end up feeling more hungry, more thirsty, more like, this is empty. Or maybe it's your family. Maybe it's your marriage. Maybe you're putting expectations on your spouse to say, you need to be perfect and complete me in every way possible. And marriage is a good thing, right? It's an amazing thing. Family and kids are an amazing thing. But if you make it the place of God in your life, you will expect things of your family or your wife or husband that only God can do, and that will crush them. It will actually destroy them. And Jesus is saying, don't give your life. You need God at the top and to put all these other pieces and fit them in and around it. But if you put these other places first, you're going to end up living a ruined life. You're going to lose your soul along the way. Don't do that. Follow me. The sinful, broken parts of your hearts, they need to die and be replaced. Come follow me on that process. Let me do it. And that's the invitation, and that's the challenge, that there's really only true life here in the person of Jesus, and a Messiah who suffers. It's the Messiah that Peter didn't really know he needed. He wanted a certain type of Messiah, and Jesus says, I'm not going to give you the one you want. You know, I'm going to be what you want for me, but I'm actually going to be what you need. I'm going to be the Messiah who will suffer in your place, sacrifice myself for you in order to bring new life to this whole world. I'm going to conquer the root of all your problems, the mess in your heart. I'm going to take it to the grave and be raised to new life. That's what I'm really going to do. And that's why he says, come and follow me on this path. Now, it ends then with these two verses in our passage. We're not going to spend a lot of time. We'll pick up one of them next week. But Jesus ends with an even more sobering thought. Look in verse 27. He says, the Son of Man is going to come with his angels and in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he has done. There will be a day when Jesus returns and we have to give an account and say, here's my heart. Here's what I've done with it. And that is a incredibly sobering and scary thought. And that's where Jesus, he gives this message of hope at the same time of the challenge and the reality that we have to give an account to God. And he says, and I'm willing to be a suffering sacrificial lamb for you, to pay the price for you on that day. That's what I've come to do. And then he goes on in verse 28, he says, truly I say to you, there's some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Now this phrase we're actually going to unpack more next week because it ties in to what another piece of what Jesus reveals about himself. He kind of pulls the veil back to his disciples a little bit more even next week. And so come back, we'll unpack that more. So this passage, it's a lot here, right? It's a lot in just these few verses, and it's pretty intense and heavy stuff, but at the heart of it, it's Jesus, at this point in the Gospel of Matthew, as things have intensified, he's saying, this is really who I am. I'm the Messiah who suffers, and I am inviting you to follow me down this path that will be hard, but it'll actually bring true life for you. And it leaves us saying, okay, number one, what do I really believe about Jesus? Who really is this person? And is he worthy for me to give my life to? And then secondly, to say, where have I tried to make him define his own path for me in my life? Where have I set the agenda for God or the things I want him to rescue me from? And I actually need Jesus to tell me what he's about. And then the third to think about as we take up our cross, what areas of our heart, maybe it's the whole thing and you're like, I need to give the whole thing up, Jesus. Or maybe it's just different pieces of your life where you're like, I'm on a dead end road right now and I need a master builder to build something new and to replace it. And to think about where we need that renewal. And with that, let's pray and give God the praise for what he's done. Jesus, we thank you that you have come, that you didn't leave us alone in this mess, but that you came as Messiah to really reveal your heart, to rescue a broken, messy world, to walk with us through our struggles, and to build your church, to build a new people following you. Lord, the broken parts of our hearts, our lives are many, and we ask for your help, ask for your spirit to convict, but also to lead us down a path of new life, to do something different as we follow your leading. And Jesus, help us to see you, to know you deeper through this process. And we thank you because you paid every penny we owe. You paid the price for all that we've done in order to give us new life. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.